Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Michelle Meek, Assistant Professor of Communication Studies at Bridgewater State University. And we're talking about the book she just edited, Independent Female Filmmakers, a chronicle through interviews, profiles, and manifestos. Michelle, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book is really wonderful, and I want to start right out. This has got to be a textbook in some classes somewhere because it's tailor-made to be used as a resource.
Absolutely. I mean, truly, my hope is that it will be used in film history classes because as much as obviously it could be used as a textbook in women's film classes or women in film classes, I also think it's an important part of film history, just generally speaking, and we need to start integrating more voices into those kinds of classes too.
I would really hope so, that it wouldn't just be relegated to only feminist filmmaking classes, which it's made for, and that's great. But the whole point of this book is this should be part of the regular dialogue about filmmaking.
Absolutely. I mean, that is really the truth. So, you know, I mean, just because women have often been excluded from lists like the National Film Registry or, you know, American Film Institute puts out 100 greatest films of all time and there's not one female director on the whole list. That, you know, we need to be careful about not only how we're moving forward, but how we're looking back at film and making sure that the legacy of the filmmakers that exist is preserved and remembered and reflected on and talked about and et cetera.
Now, in the preface to this book, I think it was written by Patricia White. Mm-hmm. She said it was a time of cautious optimism about filmmaking opportunities for women in the United States. Frankly, at this time in the United States, I'm surprised there's any cautious optimism if you're a woman doing anything.
Right. I mean, the sort of irony of it is, I think, you know, that had Hillary Clinton been elected president, we might be in a very different position right now in a lot of ways. And in some of those ways, oddly, it might not be as fiercely empowering for women, because I think what Trump being elected did was make it so urgent that women start talking about sexual harassment, exploitation, and talk about equality and fairness and all of those things. It became more of a life or death type situation. Obviously, there have been a lot of setbacks as a result, but I think the urgency has really come to the surface in a new way.
Anger is a really good motivator.
Yeah, I guess that's part of it. And you know, just suddenly you really feel the threat to your rights. And I think that whole thing that happened with him, where it got exposed, where he was talking about how he could grab women. I mean, it was just, that's what really launched the Me Too movement. And so I think that the fact that it's gone so to the top, you know, is a fact that now we really just can't ignore that this is just happening in some little dark corner. This is just everywhere, and we need to face it head on.
Let's address some of the basic issues and the challenges for women filmmakers, especially independent female filmmakers. And just for the benefit of the audience, this effect of institutional bias has impacts on every aspect of filmmaking for women. Talk about that.
So, I mean, obviously, as many people are probably aware, it has been more difficult for women to get their films made and funded. It's very sometimes hard to measure or, you know, quantify the types of discrimination that have existed and the force that they've really can kind of havoc on women's career. For example, you know, women will have a very successful first feature that's critically acclaimed and commercially successful, and then she'll have difficulty getting her second feature made. Why is that? Because in most cases, there are plenty of male filmmakers who, when they have a first successful feature, they're handed over, you know, their next project on a platter. So Martha Coolidge, Maria Magenti, and many others in the book talk about this specifically, how, you know, they're just not getting the same red carpet rolled out for them as a lot of the male filmmakers. And that was, it's hard to really measure it, like I said, but it's there and it's very ever present.
Well, Maria Magenti had a very successful independent film, The Incredibly True Adventures of Two Girls in Love.
Right.
And then it took her 6 years to get funding for her next film. Again, so is it this simple that it's just really discrimination against women and that's it?
I mean, I think it was a combination of things. I mean, I think that her film is also about two girls falling in love, so it felt like a niche film, perhaps, to some people.
So and people were just afraid that she was going to do another film. Like, no other filmmaker does that.
Right. And I think there is this tendency that, you know, a couple of the women filmmakers talk about how when they made a film that had some kind of LGBT focus, that then they were a lesbian filmmaker. And they didn't really feel like that was defining for them. That was just one of the projects that they had done or one topic that they're interested in. Maybe it personally is, you know, important to them. But it's not to say that they can't direct and write other things and that their work actually can't be extremely mainstream, even though it is about two girls falling in love. And I think, you know, when you look at that comparison to some other male directors, like look at Wes Anderson's career. Yeah, I mean, his first film, Bottle Rocket, was a commercial and critical failure. I mean, you know, it didn't do well at the box office. People didn't seem to really get it. I actually really like that film, but it was neither a commercial or a critical success, and yet he got another project right away, you know? So there's something odd at work here, for sure.
Now, one of the things that I also want to address right off is that one of the things this book is sort of a celebration of the Independent Film and Video Monthly. Right. And I need you to sort of talk about its history and why that journal was important and how this book is sort of keeping up the sort of archives of that journal.
Absolutely. So the Independent Film and Video Monthly was a print publication from 1976 to 2006. And it was run by the Association of Independent Video and Filmmakers, AIVF, as people came to know it as. And it was an organization in New York, but it was throughout the United States. And it was really an advocacy group for grassroots and independent filmmakers. But the magazine represents a really important historical document in terms of the interviews and the profiles and the manifestos really that were all of these filmmakers were represented in. And so my idea for the book really came out of my passion for that magazine because I was part of a group in 2007 that came in to rescue the archives of the Independent when the parent organization AIVF was going under. And so our priority was to digitize the archives to make sure the print magazines were in different libraries across the country, which they are now. This book came out of the idea of sort of publishing some of those past interviews, profiles, and manifestos, but we decided to do it as sort of a then and now so that we could then reconnect with the filmmakers and see how they now reflect back upon their work many years later.
Are these archives available to educational institutions?
Absolutely. They are free and available on the website independent-magazine.org. And if you click on the link for archives, all of the archives are digitized and freely available through there and through the Internet Archive. So they are free to search and download all the PDFs and to use. We want people to be able to start using them and writing about these films and using the content that's there for sure.
Now, that said, one of the things I read in the book is that, yes, it was alternative activists and grassroots, but the number of women featured in this journal were still very few.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's ironic because there were a lot of female editors, too, but there still was the perception that even the independent and the grassroots or the art filmmaker was often male. So women and, you know, black filmmakers or different nationality filmmakers were often kind of grouped together. So there would be like an indigenous people filmmakers issue or something like that. So it felt a little bit more like an additive approach where they were kind of bringing in other types of groups to add into what was mostly white male filmmakers. But nevertheless, they were doing a lot more interviews with some of these people at an early stage, way before their careers really took off. And so it really represents an important historical document.
Now, I'm going to straight line you with this one. What's the situation with independent filmmakers in general in the United States versus in other countries, say in Europe or in Asia?
Well, you know, I think that the grants for films are competitive in places like Canada and Europe, too. I think we sometimes idealize how great European filmmakers and Canadian filmmakers have it, but it's really also quite competitive in those places to get those kinds of grants. There are more of those types of funding opportunities, perhaps. But there's also a less robust kind of commercial system in those countries. And so there's just tremendous demand for American-produced content everywhere around the world. I mean, I was really surprised in lecturing in Berlin, Germany, how the students here watch a lot of American media, not so much a lot of German media. That was very surprising to me. And so there's just more demand for content produced in America by Americans. And so there's more opportunity, I think.
Now, when you say content, are you talking about like way commercial content? Or are you talking
about television or film?
Oh, man. I mean, so the passion is for American commercial content?
Well, you know, like the students that I talked to here, I was surprised that because I was interested in some of the topics that I talk about in my research, how they were different in some of the films here. But they actually watch a lot of American films or American television shows on Netflix and things like that. So they're actually watching more of the same types of content that we're all watching than I had realized.
Now, just a couple of general questions about the challenges of independent filmmaking. It always seems that the biggest challenge for anybody making an independent film is getting the film viewed. Has that changed with alternative venues now in the last 10 or 15 years? Like you can watch it online. Is that benefiting women filmmakers?
I mean, it has and it hasn't. It's really, you know, with every new technology comes its advantages and disadvantages. Obviously, I think one of the greatest things about all of these kinds of new technologies is the opportunity for filmmakers to reach, to connect directly with their audiences. And, you know, some of the crowdfunding and crowdsourcing types of campaigns are meant to do just that, so that you can seek out and find and impact the audience that you want. That said, it is, of course, really hard to get noticed when there's so much content, and that, you know, and obviously the main kind of channels now they may not be ABC, NBC, they may be Netflix or Amazon, but those kinds of channels are now really have the power to control the majority of what we're watching or knowing about. So it's still really, the discovery is kind of no easier in some way, because it's hard to find out about great content that you might actually like that is being produced by someone who's independent.
So for things like Netflix and for premium channels like HBO and whatever, this is not offering that many new opportunities for independent women filmmakers.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that. I think they are. I do think they are, because I think a lot of the women actually are working on shows that are for some of those different kinds of channels than before. You know, Jennifer Fox's film, who I interview in the book, The Tale, was actually picked up for distribution by HBO. So I think that those types of outlets actually do support women filmmakers a lot. There's just, you know, there has to be more happening on the funding side. If you can't even get your film kind of made, it's hard to then get it distributed, you know? And Jennifer Fox is a really interesting person to talk to about this, because she really is so adept at the financing part, which is part of the reason why she's been so successful. You know, she doesn't think about how, if it's going to get funded, she really thinks about how, and every film she's done has been financed a different way. And, you know, that kind of determination is really hard to sustain. But I think there's especially for a new up and coming female directors, I think there are more opportunities. I mean, there was just an article in The Wrap about how Hollywood was going to have something like 5 times the number of female directed films this year than in past years. That's an enormous increase. Wow. And of course, it's still a minority. But the fact that there's that kind of movement is promising. You know, but the numbers don't lie, and we need to look at what are actually out there in terms of festivals, what are actually produced in terms of the top grossing films. And there are studies on this, and so far they've been showing that the numbers have not really moved that much in the past 20 and more years. So we need to start seeing some movement in that direction. And I hope that that's coming soon.
Is there even a more basic problem in educating an audience to look more critically and in a different way about film?
I absolutely think so. Yes. Yes. A million times. Yes. I think that, you know, we're kind of accustomed to seeing the same story over and over again, and it's comforting to us. But, you know, I just think so critically about films. And so it causes me to think differently when I watch a film. You know, mm-hmm, I was just talking to a friend about the film A Star Is Born, and some of the issues that I have with that film. I mean, her love for him is so self-destructive to her. I mean, how is this a good relationship for her to really be in? And so I think that the more we're kind of critically thinking about what is the real message here that we're getting, we might start to seek out content that is more innovative or new. And I really think that we should all be encouraged to just see content that's different, that makes us think differently, or maybe even makes us a little uncomfortable sometimes in terms of more experimental work. I mean, you know, a film like Miranda July's You and Me and Everyone We Know.
I love that film
so much. And why shouldn't everyone enjoy a film like that? Because it's so interesting and different and quirky and fun and enjoyable on so many levels, even though it doesn't have like a traditional kind of trajectory.
I often think it's like our diet for films is like our diet in general in this country. And that it's, I think it's really easy to get sort of seduced into this sort of big action sort of comfort films that do certain things. And people really, you really need to educate an audience in order to sit back and say, okay, let's try something different. As soon as, I swear, it's like asking a kid to eat green beans. You know, it's like, I don't want to try anything different. You know, that's, I go to movies because I want to relax. That's what you hear. That's
right, right.
And so there's going to be a whole different attitude about cinema and what it can do.
I guess you're right. I mean, when I think about the Marvel movies.
And oh, God, see, I think that's the potato chips of film.
Right. And I mean, you know, it's not to say that they aren't doing some things that are interesting, because they, you know, I think they are. And they're also picking up on the cultural moment that we're in, and they're really profiting from it, right?
I mean, yeah, I was going to say ka-ching.
Right. You know, but they're a organization that's made to make money. And so it's all about the return on investment, and they want to do take as few risks as possible. You know, whereas with someone who's making a film as a passion project, as an independent filmmaker, they might still have a good return on investment, but they're also making the project because they're really passionate about it. And they want this, you know, they have this idea or this message or this, you know, creativity that they need to get out there. And yes, I want us all to kind of be open to responding to that kind of media as well.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Michelle Meek, Assistant Professor of Communication Studies at Bridgewater State University. And we're talking about the book she edited and contributed to, Independent Female Filmmakers, A Chronicle Through Interviews, Profiles, and Manifestos. You know, I'm always amazed by artists like Miranda July, and there's several of them in this book who not only are they filmmakers, but they're performance artists, they're writers, they're sort of doing a multitask career. Right. And I'm amazed that anybody can make that work. And Miranda July is a good example of that. I mean, she's a multi-talented person.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I think that we have this tendency to then look at their body of work and think, oh, that's too scattershot. And we don't know. They're, you know, whereas I think as academics, we need to look at their work as, even though they may have made different types of films, you know, she's made films and she's also written books. Like you said, she's also done performance. So look at her body of work as a comprehensive kind of piece. And even though it spans different kinds of genres and formats, that doesn't mean that she has a thread that runs through her own career. It just may not be in the way that Woody Allen's does or something like that. You know, it's just different. But that doesn't make it lesser than.
I'm just going to ask a few questions about certain of the filmmakers. Martha Coolidge. She directed two of my favorite films, Valley Girl and Real Genius, mm-hmm. Rambling Rose, Introducing Dorothy Dandridge. I mean, and yet she still has challenges in trying to get another film made.
That, I think, is where we really get to the heart of this is actually discrimination, and it's hard to disprove because you look at someone like that who had two enormously successful, commercially successful films, Valley Girl and Real Genius. I mean, any male filmmaker after two films like that would have had an easy time for the rest of their career getting films, even if they had made a couple of bombs, truthfully. And she says this, you know, and she would often say that she would look around and say, how come I'm not getting projects like that? And, you know, there really was only one reason for that.
Oh, yeah. And first of all, there's a certain tone to both those films, you know, that is unique. And I'm going to attribute it to her sensitivities and directing, because there's a different kind of feel to both of those films. But, you know, you just read about exactly what you said. She tremendous success, and then she has a difficulty getting a film made. Now, there's difficulty in getting a film made, and there's real difficulty getting a film made. And I want to talk about Deepa Mehta.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Man, that's like a whole other level of challenge of getting a film made.
Right. I mean, that's where the determination on the project really is unbelievable. And she doesn't even really make a big deal about it. You know, she wanted to make the film Water, which is about women in India who are widowed, and sometimes at an extremely young age. And this is it was a look back in time, but it was when she was making it, it was still, even though this was the, you know, 21st century, extremely controversial. People did not want this film to be made in India. They felt like it reflected badly on them, and they didn't want it to, they didn't want it. And they protested, they threatened, they, you know, all of this, and she had to stop production at one point. And, you know, she talks about how she had to pull back and not move forward with kind of anger on the project, and instead really just took time off and worked on other things for a while. And when she came back to it, she was ready to move on and do it anyway. She had to film it somewhere else. I think it was in Indonesia or something where she ended up actually doing a filming. But, you know, and it, of course, it ended up, you know, being this Academy Award winning masterpiece. And it's a beautiful film. So interesting and so much to talk about.
And it's a part of a trilogy that she did. There was Fire, right. Earth, and Water. And I mean, talk about a person
and
who's
fire, yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and dogged determination about getting a film made, and you have political mobs on your tail. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing.
Right.
How many of these filmmakers end up doing jobs like in commercial television? Because that's the thing that's paying the bills for the time being. I know that Maria Magente ended up working on Supergirl, and that's actually a long history of women sort of going into commercial television because that's what's going to pay the bills day to day. I was just watching an episode of the old TV series Thriller that was directed by Ida Lupino. And so is that one way around this, is to sort of relegate yourself to television?
Well, I think that, you know, in the past, and Maria Magente talks about this, how she moved over to television at a time when it did feel like you were being relegated to television, like it was a step down. But I think that, you know, now there's a much different perception about television, because I think that filmmakers have started to see television as the place where you can get funding and keep some creative control if you're the creator of the show itself, not necessarily if you're just a director of an individual episode, which is a totally different thing. And so there's been a lot of filmmakers who in this book, Cheryl Dunye from years back, you know, her film she did for HBO. There's Lisa Cholendanko, right, did a series for was it HBO? No, a television series as well. I think it was also HBO. So there have been a number of filmmakers who moved over to television, not only because it was the only thing they could do, but it was the best option actually for getting funding and for maintaining that creative control. So quite a lot of them have done television, which is one of the reasons why, again, if we make the criteria for an auteur to be that they've made a series of feature films that all have some similar thematic idea behind them, you know, you're going to exclude a lot of people that really don't need to be excluded from film history.
By the way, I want to mention she has a great manifesto in this book.
Yeah, Maria Magente, right?
Yeah, that's like sort of screw romance, screw motherhood. You just got to go out and get the damn film done and make sure to get a sense of humor about yourself to do it. Right. I think that should be read by every filmmaker in the world.
Absolutely. And if you agree with some of the things or don't agree with some of the things, that's fine. But, you know, let's start having conversations about what the assumptions we're making are so that we can disrupt them.
We just have a few minutes left, and there's so many more film directors to talk about. Annie Sprinkle and Beth Steffens, that was the most unusual. That was very trippy.
It is. I know. That's what their work is. You know, I mean, Annie Sprinkle was the first PhD that had worked as in pornography. You know, I mean, she's just an extremely unusual person.
But she's always been a very positive, upbeat person.
Absolutely. I mean, she's a sex positive person. She's, you know, very open sexually. It's very radical the way she has looked at sex and the way she's depicted sex. And, you know, it was important for me to include different types of women filmmakers like her, because I felt like they are often the women filmmakers that academics will then exclude because they're, quote, not appropriate.
Well, I found the whole idea of she's brought that energy to the environment and ideas about the environment, and has made a series of films with her partner I've never seen any of them. Now I'm going to go out and watch them.
Absolutely. I mean, what they're doing is so unique and different, and it's great to see how it's starting to resonate. You know, they just had a screening at MoMA, a couple of screenings, I think, there. So, I mean, you know, the more that work that's different and really giving you, making you think and feel in different ways that gets out there, the better.
We're completely out of time, and we just scratched the surface of this book. I wanted people to know that there's a lot more directors, and realize that there's extensive interviews with these people, and there's all as well as sort of biographies of them. Each chapter is a different director. My guest tonight has been Michelle Meek, assistant professor of communication studies at Bridgewater State University, and we're talking about the book that she edited and contributed to, Independent Female Filmmakers, a chronicle through interviews, profiles, and manifestos. Michelle, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.